Welcome back. Thanks for joining us, friends, on this Monday as we continue through the book of Genesis. Today, I really kind of a new, we start a new chapter, not a new chapter in the book, but a new part of the story. And for the rest of Genesis, we're going to get major chunks of story, and then we'll get some other kind of stories interspersed that are either tangential or just kind of off on their own. But today, at least today, maybe today and tomorrow, we will be looking at the next characters in the patriarchy story. So at this point, Isaac is on the scene with Rebecca, and we then join their story in verse 19 of chapter 25. So let me read this and we'll talk about it. These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padaran, sister Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it's to be this way, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." Why don't we stop there, Michael? So in some ways, echoes of familiar things that we've heard. Before we get into the actual nuts and bolts of this story, we've seen some of these things before. We've seen barrenness. We've seen that is a common theme in Genesis, where a couple is not able. Isaac himself is the product of that long period of not being able to have a child. And in this case, we have that in a relatively short telling. The narrative part of that barrenness theme is really pretty easy here. In fact, we're told he prays for her because she was barren first. We're told he prayed for her because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer. Now, we don't know what the time frame is here, and it's not to negate the struggle of their story or the pain of that moment, but it is to say, as the story is told, it's not given a lot of emphasis. It doesn't have a weight in the way that it's told here, though we again see it as a theme.
Right, yeah. So God is continuing to work amidst, you know, the human inability to force this promise to move forward. God is the one who's in the driver's seat, such that he prays, Isaac prays, and it is that supplication to the eternal God, we see having effect, which God grants, and then, you know, this blessing comes. You mentioned at the end of our last conversation, Clint, which for some reason today feels like it was forever ago, you mentioned how really shockingly, in light of what we've just been through in the binding of Isaac story, how we talked about how that was such a central turning point in Genesis, what this story does is I think it accentuates the point you were making, Clint, that ultimately Isaac is really not given a whole lot of emphasis in the book of Genesis. So that Abraham's story was teased out over chapters, Isaac's story in one verse. You go from barrenness to prayer to their children, and really the substantial meaty part of this story is now immediately going to move to Isaac's sons and not to Isaac himself. So if there's really anything notable here for me, Clint, right off the bat, is it's how little we hear about Isaac, who's really been worked up to this entire time. Once we get to Isaac, the line just keeps on moving, and it happens quickly.
Yeah, I want to be generous here, and this will not sound like complimentary language, but I don't mean it not to be. In some stories, in some way, Isaac's story is not particularly exciting. And what I mean by that is there's no real fundamental struggle. You know, Abraham, we saw all of those kind of wrestlings. We'll get a little bit of that in chapter 26 as Isaac interacts with some other people. The Jacob and Esau story becomes very loaded with conflict and challenge and struggle. We go layers deep in that story. But Isaac is born, he gets married, he has children, and that really, we just see those high points. We don't have a lot in terms of the narrative of Genesis. We don't have a lot that hangs on Isaac. We don't. Isaac is not, he's an essential character, but he's not a very fleshed out character. In fact, almost everything we learn about Isaac from this point on, we learn not as his own story, but as his role in other people's story. Is that fair?
Well, it's not only fair. I think the next time we're really going to encounter Isaac in a substantial way, it's a show-off between the two sons, and he's already of great age. So, I mean, fundamentally, there's not substantial – no, that's not totally true. But, I think at some point you've got to reckon for the fact that the story arc is going to begin to move faster, where we had really settled in on Abraham – and Sarah and Ishmael and Hagar with these, you know, interlocking, fleshed-out characters. You even had Abraham's nephew thrown into that mix. Here, we're not going to have that. Here, we're going to suddenly hone in on the exact line, the sort of arc of God's promise, and we're going to follow it, and it's going to pick up speed here.
The other thing in this story that I think can get lost, because where we go from here is very much a story of kind of sibling rivalry, of kind of classic competition, of one-upsmanship. That's not only true in the Jacob-Esau relationship, but it's true in Jacob's story in some other ways as well. What can get lost in that is what is predicted here. When Rebekah goes to inquire of God about the pain and the struggle that she's in, he says, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you will be divided. So it is hard to keep in mind, but I think it's very important to remember that this is a story not only about people, but about peoples, about nations, about groups. Jacob and Esau are going to, as Abraham did before them, symbolize people groups. We've seen this before, but it's difficult when a story is trying to carry two realities at once not to focus more on one than the other. And I think just a reminder as we get into these stories that if you can hold on to the idea that this isn't just telling you about these brothers, but about the people these brothers will inevitably become and father, I think it's helpful. I think that it provides something that the story is intended to do in the way it's told.
We've seen a lot of themes, Clint, already worked into the book of Genesis. We've certainly looked at faith and the lack of faith. We've looked at the idea of debauchery or sinfulness versus righteousness. We've looked very much at impatience and sort of pushing ahead, trying to force God's will. Here, with the introduction of Isaac and moving so quickly to his sons, we're moving in with a not a brand new theme, but a new emphasis with this idea of jealousy and reaching and grabbing and trying to hold and take for oneself. We've not really had Abraham and Lot. You had the situation where they were quarreling over land, and really Abraham made a very classy move in saying, you know, take whatever you want. There's some other, you know, segments of the story there, but here we're going to see a kind of internal family conflict set up, which is going to at that macro view, do exactly what Clint is saying. It's going to show us these people groups, how they get formed, and why there may also continue to be some rivalry between them. But then it also sets up that this promise is now being tested by the rivalry itself, that there is some question, which of these brothers is going to be the one who's going to get literally the upper hand? Who's going to be the one to be smarter or stronger as it will play out? And in asking that question, we, the reader, are supposed to ask, is there any human choice or element that is going to derail God's plan? Isaac becomes a very quick gateway to asking a new set of questions about the fragility of this promise.
Right. And in the first instance, as we enter the story here, it is natural that nation business, that idea that these are people groups or that each of these boys represents a nationality or an identity is kind of off in the horizon. So we enter it at the personal level. So let me read the rest of the passage here, and then we can flesh it out. When her time came to give birth, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, his body all hairy, and so they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in the tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So we learn so much in these few verses. We learn that Esau, he comes out ruddy, red, like a person who had been in the sun, hairy. These are traits assimilated or associated with masculinity. His name has something to do with that idea. And then we learn later that he's a skillful hunter. He's a man of the field. He is a kind of man's man. He goes out, he hunts, he gets food, he kills things. He's comfortable outside. He's durable. He's all of those things. And we see that even forecasted in his birth. And then on the other hand, his brother is something different. Grabbing his heel, and the name Jacob means it literally means heel grabber, or the one who supplants, the one who replaces. And we have this promise hanging over their relationship that the younger will be served by the older. That unlike the culture that says even though they're separated only by moments, the oldest has the inheritance. The firstborn, even if only by a minute, is the one who is guaranteed the wealth and riches of his family. The secondborn is not privileged to the same amount of inheritance. And yet, this promise hanging over is that the younger is going to be blessed. The younger is going to be served by the older. And it's not exactly clear how much or how little we're being told here, but Jacob is a man living in the tents. Now, that tends to be associated with where the women hang out. We're going to find out later that Jacob cooks, and evidently he cooks pretty well. It's not entirely clear that this is saying something effeminate, because Jacob is going to prove in his own way he's very strong. He's very resilient. He is very hardy, but he is not. He's something other than Esau. He's quiet, and he kind of sticks to himself. And again, this is sort of a summary not only of these two boys, but of two male types, kind of archetypes of what it means to be a man. And we have them clearly described here.
So I think there's an interesting detail here that's not even about Jacob or Esau per se, but actually it's about Isaac. Verse 28, Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, which is a really kind of functional form of love, right? The idea that he likes to eat the food that Esau is capable of getting and bringing back. But it says Rebekah loved Jacob. And here we see that the conflict that we've already introduced between these two brothers also in some measure exists between mother and father, that we see this at the parental level existing not just between these two brothers. And so the question that hangs over this, of course, is when you set it up with this oracle, this prophecy, that the the older will serve the younger, we as the reader have been led into that. We know that already. And of course, we're naturally inquiring, well, how is that going to work out? And that's exactly how this story serves. It both sets up these macro stories of the nations that Clint led with. It also points us down the road to say, this is where you need to look, because there's something different going to happen in this story. Even the name of supplanting is really, it's giving us a clue. There's something substantial going to happen here. And if this sounds strange to you, I think this is actually very contemporary. Rochelle and I joke all the time, because there are some things when we talk about our daughters today, we joke about looking back at their birth, how it was true then. An example, Emily, we think of as being a very perceptive individual. She's always sort of studying her world to see what's happening. I mean, we look back to the very night that she was born, and she surprised the nurses because of her perceptiveness. Her eyes were open. She was bright. It was a sort of odd behavior for a baby just born, but she was really attentive. Now, did we read into that story? I mean, absolutely. We're casting a narrative backwards. But my point is, Clint, that I think this is a natural sort of parenting thing. We look at who our children become, and we can't help but look backwards and see those threads that stretched all the way back to the beginning. And here, Scripture is presenting it in such a way so that we can really condense that life cycle. We can jump right into the conflict, which is the thing at hand. The thing at hand is going to be what will come of these two brothers and this tension between them. But what is happening is, with some great economy, we're being set up for how to get there.
Yeah, this text is very purposeful in drawing a division, and if not inviting us to take sides, at least asking us to realize that there are sides, right? We start with Esau is this kind of man, Jacob is this other kind of man. Then we get Isaac loved Esau, and we get Rebekah loved Jacob. So we have this idea that there are clearly two teams. And what that functions in the story to do for us is to say the covenant promise is passed down through the oldest. Everybody knows that, right? Abraham said, what about Ishmael? No, he's not the real one. I'm taking the other one. I'm taking your firstborn with Sarah. What about all these other kids he had with his second wife? No, they're fine. I'll take care of them. But Isaac is the one. Here we have a clear-cut case that Esau should be the one. And yet hanging over this story is that prophecy, the younger will be served by the elder. And now we have the division. We have teams. It's Rebekah and Isaac. I'm sorry. It's Rebekah and Jacob. It's Isaac and Esau. And we then move forward in this question mark, in this tension of what does this all mean for the covenant? Who is going to bear this promise now going forward? It has landed on Isaac. We saw that, waited for it for years. Now where does it go? And that's the question this story will answer. Well, this series of stories.
Yeah, right. And Clint, isn't the thing that makes us immediately uncomfortable is that human drama is in the middle of God's story. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only in the middle, in some ways it is the bridge that God's story is given to us through, right? This idea that brothers are fighting over a birthright, even from the moment of birth that one is grasping, is, I mean, in some way very uncomfortable to people who are reading this to see the revelation of God. Yet it is in the messy human reality that we discover God is indeed alive and at work. And it's, of course, Christians thousands of years later, far beyond these texts, who come to believe and to proclaim that God took on flesh. He didn't even have his story and his purpose and his promise go through human action, that God would take on humanity in order to effect the change. So what we see here is uncomfortable. The substance of the Christian faith goes even further, and I find that striking as we read a story like this.
Yeah, we'll have to cover some ground, but I hope we can get through the family stories this week and keep them together, because this is one of those fascinating moments in the scripture where God has a word that hangs over the text, and then in the rest of the text, God is really not mentioned. The things that happen after this seem to be in keeping with the prophetic word that God has uttered. The older will serve the younger. But when it comes to the playing out of that, even in some ways that look very questionable and sketchy, God really doesn't have a role. God doesn't seem to speak on it one way. It's not clear that God is in favor. It's not clear that God isn't in favor. And yet it brings about the very thing that God said it would. And which of those came first? And I think those are fascinating questions. We will do our best to get through that cycle of stories so that we don't leave them hanging over Christmas, because I do think they're best understood if we can keep them together.
Yeah, and don't miss these conversations. This is a different pace. It's a different tone. It's a turn in the text. It's amazing that Genesis 25 verses in, or sorry, 25 chapters in, still has things to surprise us and to challenge us. So we look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Thanks, everybody.